Welcome to the podcast for the Journal of the American Academy of Physician Assistants.
Welcome, everyone. This is the first episode with your new co-host. My name is Brandon Cherry, and I will be working with Lena Ward. After months of behind-the-scenes meetings, we can finally say that the official transition of becoming your new host has finally begun. After 3 years of dedication and cultivating the podcast to what it is today, Adrian and Chris have decided to hand the ropes over. We hope to grow what they have built while also remaining committed to bringing you this information in a quick and concise fashion. Lena will give you a little background on us.
Hello, everyone.
My name is Lena Ward, and I'm so excited to be co-host of this amazing podcast with Brandon. As Brandon mentioned, we hope we continue the quality that Adrian and Chris brought to this podcast and also bring some fun and fresh ideas to keep everyone engaged. Now, a little bit about us. Both Brandon and I are internal medicine PAs in the lovely city of Philadelphia. We were also classmates and now alums from Drexel University's PA program. We graduated in 2019, for those of you who are wondering, which means we're baby PAs, so please be patient with us. But as previously mentioned, we are oh so excited to begin this journey with you all, and we are eternally grateful to Adrian and Chris, along with JAPA, for this opportunity.
Yes, that's right. We also just wanted to share that for the first few months, we will keep the same format as Chris and Adrian, and as we get into our groove and connect with you all, our audience, we will hopefully begin to switch things up.
Now, on to the CME. This month, we feature CME articles of gastroesophageal reflux disease in children and bacterial vaginosis, while also reviewing management of adult obesity as a chronic condition and a QRS on ectopic pregnancy.
This podcast is a summary of selected articles from this month's edition. We share our take and opinions, and they don't represent JAPA, the authors, or the editor's opinions, or the publisher. This is not intended as medical advice.
And remember, everyone, when you read both CME articles, review the post-test, and then take the test online at cme.aapa.org. If you get at least a 70%, you get one category CME. The first article we will be reviewing is Probiotics for Preventing Recurrent Bacterial Vaginosis by Lauren Webb. Lauren is an assistant professor in the PA program at Lipscomb University in Nashville, Tennessee. The author has disclosed no potential conflicts of interest, financial or otherwise. Bacterial vaginosis, commonly known as BV, affects 30% of women of childbearing age in the U.S. And unfortunately, 20 to 30% of these women will fail initial treatment of BV, leading to reinfection. But what is bacterial vaginosis? BV is caused by an overgrowth of normal, yes, normal, vaginal flora, such as Gardnerella vaginalis. This overgrowth is usually due to a lack of lactobacilli, which is another type of normal vaginal flora. Now, you may be wondering, what makes lactobacilli so instrumental in preventing BV when both bacteria are considered normal vaginal flora? Well, lactobacilli helps maintain a normal vaginal pH, which is between 3.8 and 4.2, so it's more on the acidic side. While the vaginal pH in BV infection is usually between 5 and 5.5, so still acidic, but not enough. Additionally, a lack of lactobacillus equals overgrowth of other anaerobes that can cause BV, like Atopium vaginae, Mycoplasma hominis, and BVAB, which stands for bacterial vaginosis-associated bacteria. Some risk factors for BV are multiple or new sexual partners, intercourse without a condom, smoking, use of an intrauterine device, recent antibiotic use. Remember, some antibiotics may lead to the decrease of normal flora, such as lactobacillus. Black and Hispanic ethnicity. Women who have sex with women. And douching. Quick sidebar. I think this last risk factor is really important to emphasize, as there sometimes is a stigma that women may face, especially younger women, to douche or use soap, when actually these products can be harmful. So I think as clinicians, it's important that we have an open discussion with our patients about this risk factor. Now, BV can be diagnosed clinically or with laboratory testing. Laboratory testing includes a vaginal smear under microscopy and looking for the presence of Klue cells or Gram stain, which is the gold standard of practice. While clinical diagnosis entails using a Nugent score or AMSL criteria. However, a Nugent score involves Gram staining, so this may be counterproductive. For AMSL criteria, a patient must meet three of the four following criteria for a diagnosis of BV to be made. One, the presence of a homogeneous, thin, grayish-white vaginal discharge. Two, a positive whiff test with the application of 10% potassium hydroxide to the sample. This reveals an amine, fishy-like odor to the sample. Three, having a vaginal pH greater than 4.5. And four, the presence of clue cells on wet mount microscopy. Now, some complications of BV include preterm pregnancy, pelvic inflammatory disease, and increased incidence of acquiring other STIs or STZs, such as HIV and HPV. For treatment, about 30% of cases of BV are self-limiting. Currently, guidelines for treatment and symptom resolution recommend oral or vaginal antibiotic therapy with either metronidazole, tinidazole, or clindamycin. However, as mentioned earlier, 20 to 30% of these cases fail antibiotic therapy after the first course. And also not to mention, there are some adverse reactions that accompany these regimens, such as vaginitis. I especially think of yeast infection, because again, we're decreasing the normal vaginal flora, which leads to opportunistic infections. I know as a student, I would sometimes educate patients on BV and talk to them about treatment, and I would also recommend they pick up an over-the-counter regimen for yeast infection. Now, as a PA, I would probably just write a prescription fluconazole if needed. Also, there's nausea. And specifically for metronidazole, the black box warning for its carcinogenic potential, neurotoxicity in the form of peripheral neuropathy, and the disulfiram reaction when used with alcohol. Also, it's contraindicated in the first term of pregnancy. For clindamycin, there's also the side effects of pseudomembranous colitis and potentially worsening vaginitis if used intravaginally, again, due to the destruction of normal flora within the GI tract. Again, we're circling back to that concept of maintaining a healthy vaginal flora to prevent BV. Given the complications from BV and potential adverse reactions from treatment, it's of utmost importance as clinicians that we also implement practices for our patients to prevent bacterial vaginosis infection. And that's where the use of probiotics comes in. Several probiotics have been proven to increase the number of vaginal lactobacilli, restore vaginal pH, and its microbiome. Some examples of these probiotics are oral and intravaginal Lactobacillus acidophilus, Lactobacillus rhamnosus GR1, and Lactobacillus fermentum RC14. Now, how does this work? Oral probiotics venture to the vaginal tract after coursing its way through the GI tract and then being excreted with a bowel movement. Once in the vaginal tract, the probiotic can then restore vaginal flora, which ultimately, again, is the pathophysiology behind BV, thus essentially preventing and possibly treating BV. However, research studies on this topic mostly involve antibiotic therapy along with probiotics or using probiotics to prevent the reoccurrence of BV, so there are some limitations. Additionally, there have been no set specifics when it comes to the route, probiotic dosing, or length of therapy. For example, one study initiated probiotic therapy in its participants for 4 menstrual cycles after the completion of antibiotic therapy with metronidazole 500 milligrams twice a day for 7 days. While on the other hand, another study had participants use probiotics with metronidazole simultaneously for 7 days, then followed by 2 probiotic capsules daily for 10 consecutive days at the beginning of the menstrual cycle. This was due to the fact that menstrual blood does increase vaginal pH, which also increases risk of BV. Lastly, some additional benefits of oral probiotics are prevention of bowel disease, improvement of overall immune health, improvement of hypercholesterolemia, hypertension, and improvement of postmenopausal symptoms. Brandon, you know what I did after reading this article?
What did you do?
I bought probiotics with lactobacillus in them, so we'll see how it goes.
Well, I'm glad to see you practice what you preach when it comes to preventative medicine. Our next CME article, Understanding Gastroesophageal Reflux Disease in Children, was written by Chloe Friedman, Gianna Sarantos, and Sarah Katz, who were at the time this article was written, students at Pace University Lenox Hill Hospital PA program in New York City, along with Cheryl Geiser, an adjunct professor in the PA program. The authors have disclosed no potential conflicts of interest, financial or otherwise. So when you think of GERD, also known as gastroesophageal reflux disease, we typically don't think of the pediatric population. However, we all know that one sibling or cousin that begins throwing up while we're holding them or watching their parents wipe it off the new bib they just bought. However, sometimes it could be indicative of something a little bit more serious, that there can be complications such as laryngitis, aspiration pneumonia, and ultimately respiratory arrest when it comes to severe symptoms of GERD. It can also lead to stress and anxiety, causing a decreased performance academically and socially for children, nutritional deficiencies, and also dental erosions and caries. Severe untreated GERD can turn into PUD, also known as peptic ulcer disease, leading to iron deficiency anemia, and worst case scenario, Barrett's esophagus, which can ultimately lead to cancer. Going over Barrett's esophagus, it's when the esophageal squamous epithelium is replaced by precancerous metaplastic columnar cells. The epidemiology when looking at pediatric GERD is that 60% to 70% of children ages 3 to 4 months experience some type of regurgitation. However, only 5% of infants experience regurgitation at the age of 1 year old. And it's also estimated that between 10.9 and 32.9% of adolescents between the ages of 12 and 18 have GERD. So we must look at what is regurgitation. Is known as the passing of gastric contents into the esophagus due to involuntary relaxation of the lower esophageal stricture. And just a refresher on the path though, the lower esophageal stricture is located at the gastroesophageal junction, and when we swallow, it relaxes to allow one-way movement of food and liquid into the stomach. The pressure of the stricture decreases but remains slightly higher than that of the lower GI tract. So essentially, there are three ways that one can experience GERD-like symptoms, and the first is that there's just frequent episodes of transient relaxation of the lower esophageal stricture, and this is when pressure relaxes despite there not being any swallowing. As this occurs, the pressure of the sphincter becomes lower than that of the intragastric pressure. And going off the concept of things moving from high to low pressure, that gives us the reason as to why we have stomach contents coming back up through the esophagus, hence the symptoms of GERD. The other way is lower esophageal stricture pressure. This pressure has to remain at a specific level, and despite slightly dropping when we swallow, it has to remain higher than that of the intragastric pressure. However, if it goes too low, then again, we experience the symptoms. And three, increased intra-abdominal pressure, which is common in those who suffer from obesity. An additional factor that served as a great reminder, haven't heard of this since taking anatomy, was the size of the angle of his, which is located below the lower esophageal stricture and above the great curvature of the stomach. The purpose of the angle of his is similar to a valve, allowing one-way movement of food and liquid. However, in infants, due to the fact that this angle may be larger, stomach contents may be more likely to have a retrograde flow. So if there's one thing to take away from the patho of all of this, it's either an increase of intragastric pressure or a decrease in lower esophageal sphincter pressure, which leads to the symptoms of GERD. So now we can look at the risk factors. One of the most common risk factors is obesity, which is something we also see in the adult population. Another one is asthma, and I never necessarily understood the correlation between the two, but one theory is that the fact that the vagus nerve innervates both the esophagus and bronchial tree, therefore the inflammation that occurs in children with asthma can also be related to the symptoms of GERD. And one of the risk factors that makes the most sense to me is prematurity, as the anatomy of the child may not be fully developed, leading to complications. So Lena, what would you say the most common clinical presentation is when it comes to GERD in the pediatric population?
I'm either going to guess stomach pain or regurgitation.
Ding, 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 ding. We're going to have to go with regurgitation. In the older population, the symptoms are very similar to that of adults, such as heartburn, epigastric pain, nausea, halitosis, and dental erosions. However, in the infant population, symptoms can be a bit more tricky since regurgitation and vomiting is common during the infant years. However, when they are associated with symptoms such as gagging, wheezing, refusing to feed, irritability, and poor weight gain, these things should be something to look out for. It was also noted that when regurgitation begins after 6 months or increases after a year, this may be a symptom of something more severe. The symptoms that are associated with GERD, specifically the postprandial regurgitation and vomiting before feeding, can also be associated with pyloric stenosis, a hiatal hernia, intussusception, celiac disease, and aspiration pneumonia, just to name a few. So just be aware to keep your wide differential. And the diagnostic workup, most importantly, we can always do a thorough history and physical, which will help eliminating other things that could be on a differential. However, when more serious symptoms are noted as the ones above, we can look into number one, esophageal pH monitoring. Number two, something called multi-channel intraluminal imidence. And I looked it up, I'd never heard it before. It measures by reflecting the changes in electrical resistance as a gas, liquid, or solid moving between two electrodes. And research has actually determined that this is the most sensitive test. Number three, barium study, ultrasound, and manometry, or a trial of PPIs. Usually, patients are given 4 to 8 weeks to see if the symptoms are improved. And number four, EGD, with or without biopsy. But this is probably something ordered by pediatric GI specialists. And the treatment for pediatric GERD is to implement lifestyle changes such as thickened formula, positional changes, and adjusting feeding volumes and intervals for infants can be useful in reducing the symptoms of GERD. Sometimes parents run into issues where they overfeed their child, which can lead to excess regurgitation. Another tip is for mothers to continue to breastfeed because it's shown that formula feeding can increase the symptoms of GERD. Maintaining a healthful weight is important in reducing the symptoms, as we touched on how obesity increases intragastric pressure. And what specific foods should be avoided in patients suffering from GERD-like symptoms?
Greasy foods, sodas, chocolate, anything delicious to a kid.
It is. The greasy, peppermint, caffeine, and chocolate are all foods that have been known to make the symptoms of GERD worse. So good job, Lena. And the use of antacids have also been shown to have symptomatic relief, but inefficient in treating the underlying causes of GERD. And when these lifestyle modifications are not helpful, the next step is to use H2 receptor antagonists and PPIs. And if symptoms don't improve with the use of those medications, surgical intervention may be warranted. Nisin fund application is a number one procedure, and it can be done laparoscopically. However, surgical interventions are only reserved for children over the age of one.
Thank you, Brandon, for that reveal. A small fun fact, actually, when I was a kid, I had GERD. I was about four, and I actually had to have a barium swallow study done. The only thing I remember from it was the dye that they had me drink was flavored like vanilla, so I thought it was a vanilla milkshake, and I actually thought it was quite delicious. But now we have a quick recertification series article on ectopic pregnancy by Holly Ann West and Russell Robert Snyder. Holly is a senior medical educator for the Office of Educational Development and an assistant professor in the Department of Obstetrics and Gynecology at the University of Texas Medical Branch at Galveston. Russell is the vice chair of obstetrics and gynecology. The authors have disclosed no potential conflicts of interest, financial or otherwise. Ectopic pregnancy is a pregnancy that occurs outside the uterine cavity. So the fertilized egg continues to develop outside of the uterus. This is also known as an extrauterine pregnancy. Most ectopic pregnancies occur in the fallopian tubes, and 96% of these ectopic pregnancies can be found in the ampullary segment of the fallopian tube. Quick anatomy refresher, the ampullary segment is the longest and widest segment. It begins at the medial portion of the infundibulum. Again, the infundibulum is the distal portion of the fallopian tube that leads to the fimbriae. Those are those weird finger-like projection things. Ectopic pregnancies can also be found in the ovaries, the abdominal cavity, cervix, and scar tissue from a previous C-section. Now, a new term for me was heterotopic pregnancy. This is an ectopic pregnancy that occurs along with an intrauterine pregnancy, and is most common in vitro fertilization. Now for some quick epidemiology. Rupture of ectopic pregnancy is the number one cause of maternal death in the first trimester, and this is due to extensive hemorrhage. Some risk factors for ectopic pregnancy are acute or recent inflammation, PID, salpingitis, chlamydia, and gonorrhea, as well as older age,
smoking, history of a previous ectopic pregnancy, history of previous pelvic or tubal surgery or tubal ligation. This is due to the adhesions from scar tissue, and use of an intrauterine device. Quick note, it is also important to reassure patients with an IUD or considering the option of an IUD that this risk factor is less likely to occur because the chance of pregnancy is less likely to occur. Now, if you have a female patient of childbearing age presenting with abdominal or pelvic pain, and ectopic pregnancy is part of your differential diagnosis, here are some things that you should include in your assessment. For history, you want to OPQRST your patient's abdominal or pelvic pain. You want to ask when their last menstrual period was, if they're sexually active, and see if they endorse any dizziness or nausea or vomiting. For vital signs, you want to look out for any tachycardia or hypotension, which are signs of shock if they are hemorrhaging. On physical exam, you want to do a thorough abdominal exam. This is to rule out an acute abdomen. For our student listeners out there, a quick reminder, some exam findings that should raise a red flag for an acute abdomen are guarding. This is a voluntary contraction of the abdominal muscles. Your patients will usually do this to avoid or reduce the amount of pain that they experience with palpation. Rigidity, which is an involuntary tightening of abdominal muscles, and rebound tenderness. This is an increase of pain when pressure is released from the abdomen. Okay, next, you want to make sure you do a pelvic exam. This should include a speculum exam to identify the source of bleeding and a bimanual pelvic exam. You should be looking for cervical motion tenderness, also known as a chandelier sign. I hate that term, by the way, but we'll discuss that in another episode. And an adnexal mass. For diagnostic testing, your number one test that you should do first is a pregnancy test. To be honest, if ectopic pregnancy is on your differential, this should probably be before the physical exam. You really want to try to rule out ectopic pregnancy as soon as you can due to the risk of rupture and hemorrhage. Circling back to our epidemiology, this is the number one cause of maternal death during the first trimester, so we don't want to miss it. Other testing should include quantitative HCG to determine if levels are within the discriminatory zone. The discriminatory zone is the level at which signs of an intrauterine pregnancy, these signs would be gestational sac, yolk sac, or an embryonic pole, will be visible on transvaginal ultrasound. The discriminatory zone is usually greater than 1500, or some may say 2000. If quantitative HCG is greater than 1500, but there is no sign of intrauterine pregnancy on transvaginal ultrasound, this is considered an ectopic pregnancy until proven otherwise. You also want to include serial quantitative HCG levels every 48 hours to trend the level of the HCG. Remember, HCG levels should double every 24 to 48 hours in a viable intrauterine pregnancy. Any increase less than this, or plateau or decrease, should make you think ectopic pregnancy or non-viable intrauterine pregnancy. You also want to order a CBC to look for anemia in case hemorrhaging is occurring. You want to have a type and screen in case your patient needs a transfusion, and Rh antibody testing. Just a reminder, if a mother is Rh negative, they will need Rh immunoglobulin, also known as RhoGAM, to prevent sensitization. Lastly, you want to order LFTs and renal function tests in case methotrexate is needed. So, for treatment, there are three options for management of ectopic pregnancy: medical, surgical, and expectant. However, there are some contraindications for each. For medical management of ectopic pregnancy, intramuscular methotrexate is the treatment of choice. Methotrexate is a folic acid antagonist and stops cell proliferation. In this case, it specifically stops trophoblastic tissue proliferation. In order for a patient to receive medical management with methotrexate, there has to be some requirements. Gestational size must be less than 4 centimeters. There has to be an absence of fetal heart tones on transvaginal ultrasound. Initial beta HCG has to be less than 5,000. Your patient also has to be hemodynamically stable. And lastly, your patient cannot have any other contraindications to methotrexate. This includes intrauterine pregnancy, aminodeficiency, and breastfeeding. Lastly, with methotrexate, you want to trend HCG on day 4 and day 7 post-injection. HCG levels decline by 15%, then continue to measure HCG levels weekly until beta-HCG is undetectable. If the decline in HCG is less than this, you want to consider a second round of methotrexate or surgical intervention. Speaking of surgical intervention, some options for your patients are laparoscopic or laparotomy, and some of these specific procedures are a linear self-bingeostomy, which is a removal of the pregnancy, a segmental resection, which is a removal of the affected tubal segment, or salpingectomy, which is removal of the entire fallopian tube. Post-surgical beta-HCG levels still may be warranted, and in some cases, methotrexate still may be needed as well. For expectant management, your patient must be asymptomatic, have an initially low beta-HCG level, and it's important to explain and ensure that they understand the risks of rupture.
For sure, for sure. Thank you, Lena. Yeah, I've had a couple situations in the ER where I had, during my rotations, I had seen women coming in with abdominal pain, and you automatically think like appendicitis or cholecystitis, but this is a very life-threatening, so it's important that this stays on people's differential when women of childbearing age come in. To wrap things up, we have a special topic in primary care with the article being titled Managing Obesity in Adults is a Chronic Condition. The article was written by Cherry Wilder Giroff, practices in internal medicine with Cornerstone Medical Care of Brandon, Florida, and is a student in the A.T. Still University Doctor of Medical Science program. The author has disclosed no potential conflicts of interest, financial or otherwise. In any specialty, we are likely to come across a number of patients who can be identified as obese. And despite the known consequences behind the condition, it is rare that we are able to properly address the issue. And the definition of obesity, if we want to go by the textbook, is a chronic, relapsing, multifactorial, neurobehavioral disease in which an increase in body fat promotes adipose tissue dysfunction, abnormal fat mass, physical forces resulting in adverse metabolic, biomechanical, and psychosocial health consequences. And with the main cause of this being an increase in calories and a decrease in activity, which results in a lower metabolic rate. And then it just creates a chain reaction where altered neurohormonal signals lead to an increased appetite. And when the body shifts to having a higher percentage of fat compared to muscle, this is what occurs. And then the visceral fat can lead to insulin resistance and inflammation. Then that chronic inflammation contributes to heart disease, diabetes, and even some cancers. The excess weight can also lead to osteoarthritis as well as obstructive sleep apnea. So now looking at the epidemiology, the numbers of a recent study conducted by the CDC between 2017 and 2018 show that the prevalence of obesity in this country is a whopping 42.4%, costing the U.S. about $1.5 trillion annually. And if we look at specific minority groups, the numbers increase to 44.8% in Hispanics and 49.6% in non-Hispanic blacks. The barriers when addressing obesity are oftentimes out of the control of the clinician, such as a lack of resources, such as transportation and access to healthy foods, as well as inadequate or no insurance. However, according to studies, the most significant barriers for patients were poor communication with healthcare providers and the lack of knowledge about resources. And the primary barriers for clinicians were poor reimbursement, lack of referral services such as a nutritionist, and time to discuss weight management during encounters with the patients. And I can personally attest to the lack of time. I guess we all can attest to the lack of time when it comes to our time with our patients. And I also think it is an important point as to why clinicians need to be familiar with the community that they're working in, because some recommendations may not be feasible for specific patient populations based on the area. For instance, if you're encouraging your patients to increase their outside activity and they don't live in a safe neighborhood, that's kind of a barrier for them. And if you're recommending specific foods that may not be accessible in their area. So the screening and evaluation for obesity All patients should be screened for obesity, and despite its many loopholes, the use of the BMI is the most common tool used in our country. If you're interested, look up the name Adolphe Quetelet, spelled A-D-O-L-P-H-E, which is his first name, and his last name is Q-U-E-T-E-L-E-T. And that'll give you a little insight on that. But back to the article. In the primary care setting, a full physical exam and laboratory evaluation should include our fasting glucose or A1C, our TSH, liver enzymes, metabolic profile, and fasting lipids, which will help give us a full picture of the patient. Nevertheless, bringing attention to the patient's weight opens the door for the opportunity to receive proper counseling, opinions for lifestyle changes, and possible treatment options. Research has determined that using the 5 A's framework has been associated with better outcomes in the primary care setting. And the article has a great little chart explaining which each of the 5 A's mean, but they're pretty straightforward. And in addition to using the 5 A's, it also makes it possible to seek reimbursement from Medicare, as they require screening for obesity in adults using the BMI, number 2, a dietary assessment, and number 3, an intensive behavioral counseling consistent with the 5 A's noted above. In addition to this information, I also learned that the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services, also known as CMS, covers one-to-one face visits every week for the first month and every other week for months 2 through 6, up to 15 minutes for each session. And weight loss reassessment has to be performed halfway through the year, and patients must have lost at least 6.6 pounds in order to be eligible for monthly visits for an additional 6 months. And the alternatives when it comes to addressing obesity, we have to look at the times that we're living in as they are changing, and there are some instances where people going into the office may not be suitable for a specific patient population. So we can look into group visits, telemedicine, and social media, which can also be helpful in managing obesity. And even though there isn't much research on social media at this point, preliminary research has shown that it is effective in increasing patient engagement, and it's an opportunity to provide social support for patients participating in these weight management programs. And to wrap things up, as clinicians, we must acknowledge the barriers in front of us that impact managing obesity in our patient population. However, we shouldn't let it discourage us. And using the 5 A's framework, as well as the evidence-based guidelines that we are provided, remaining consistent, we will be able to have a positive impact on the patients we come in contact with each and every day.
Thank you, Brandon, for that. I think it's important, you know, like how you mentioned, to know the community of your patient population. In brief, I went to a major grocery store chain here in the city of Philadelphia, and I went to one in University City that had lots of healthy options that were actually quite affordable. But then I went to the same chain in West Philadelphia, and they didn't have as many healthy options, and the options they had were more expensive. So I think it's important, like you said, to know the community. So that way, when you make recommendations to your patients, you can say, hey, I know this store may not have the best options, but if you check out this other grocery store a few blocks down, they have some more affordable and healthy options for you.
For sure, for sure.
Everyone, I hope you enjoyed our first episode, and we look forward to this new journey with you all. And make sure that you check out JAAP on social media. Their Instagram handle is at JAAPA online. And under the February issue posts, let us know your thoughts about the topics we went over today. We'd love to hear your input.
Again, everybody, thank you for tuning in. My name is Brandon, and my co-host name is Lena, and we look forward to speaking with you all next month.